featuring interviews and commentary from Animal Rights Zone, the online social network for humans who seek justice for other animals. You can find us on the web at www.arzone.net. I'm your host, Carolyn Bailey. In today's episode, Ronnie Lee, Tim Geyer, and I are pleased to welcome Dr. Stephen Bess to AR Zone. We're assisted in the research for this interview, as we always are, by Spencer Lowe. Steve Best is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Texas at El Paso, but he's perhaps best known as an advocate for the liberation of the earth and all of its animals, human as well as other animals. Steve has published 13 books and hundreds of articles and has been active nationally and internationally for more than 3 decades, challenging the conventional wisdom on topics ranging from environmentalism to sexual liberation to animal rights. Dr. Best joins us today to speak about his new book, The Politics of Total Liberation, Revolution in the 21st Century. Steve, thanks for joining us today and welcome to AR Zone.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure and honor.
You're very welcome. Steve, our listeners would be familiar with the term animal liberation. However, your new book speaks about total liberation. Would you please explain what that term means?
Sure. Total liberation has two components to it. One is a theoretical or methodological component, and the other is a political component. The first component, theoretical, is a way of looking at the world. And the second component is a way of trying to change the world. So when we look at how to look at the world historically, theoretically, what happened in the past, what's happening now, how structures of hierarchy and oppression over in history over at least the last 10,000 years have evolved, we look at the world from what I call the animal standpoint, and we look at how various kinds of oppression, domination, and hierarchy are interwoven with one another, that these are mutually supporting systems of power. So total liberation, theoretically, means first that we look at history from a systematic viewpoint. We look at history dialectically, holistically, if you will, and how these various systems overlap. Then, and we really look at the animal standpoint, how the oppression, human oppression of animals, the human exploitation of animals is central to all forms of power, domination, hierarchy, and exploitation in history. Then once we understand that, that centrality of the human relation to the animal, this has to factor into our politics and the political struggles of today, of the 21st century, of this incredibly pivotal time in history. And so that means that we form an alliance politics. If forms of power are interconnected, that means that our struggles should be too. And so we try to develop a new kind of politics, total liberation, where we work together. Human, earth, and animal liberation are all interrelated projects. They really can't be fought one separate from the other. And this is in distinct contrast with the politics of the animal rights movement or animal liberation movement, which is typically single issue, which is typically we just focus on liberating animals and we ignore these other issues. Total liberation says no, these issues are interconnected historically, socially, politically, and then we must fight for them accordingly.
Can you explain who you're hoping to reach with the new book?
What I'm trying to do is to speak to the animal rights movements, the human rights and social justice movements, and the environmental movements. And I'm trying to say, hey, we need to fight together because we are fighting very core forms of oppression that are interrelated. And while we in the animal rights movement have typically ignored your struggles, you have ignored ours. We are, unfortunately, by and large, ignorant of one another's struggles. We each have a dismal and negative view of other movements, and we each have been fighting our own battles, decontextualized from other battles. And we really need to see the systematic issues here. We need to look at history differently. We need to look at politics differently. We need to look at our various struggles differently. We need to see that we are only strong in unity with one another, and that no struggle for emancipation can be won without fighting battles for other forms of emancipation.
What practical steps can we take to create an alliance between animal liberationists and other movements for social justice and environmental protection? And what vehicles can we use to give that movement influence in society?
The first thing is awareness of just how far off we are from this target. If you look at how animal rights or animal liberationist people view other struggles, you can see that, we typically point out the speciesism embedded in social justice movements and certainly also in the environmental movement. And we tend to dissociate from that and try not to deal with that problem and just work things on our own. Partly, we feel that we're going to be co-opted into the humanist speciesist emphases of these other struggles. But the first thing we need besides realization on all sides, and let me say also that we need to be aware of how they view us. And if you go on IndyMedia, for instance, the various websites that are very focused on left struggles, social justice struggles, and how they view and frame the animal rights movement, they say things that are very harsh, that are very ignorant, and that are not very different from what we would find from mainstream speciesist people. So we see that they have really no understanding of what vegans, animal rights, and animal liberationists have to offer to the healing of the earth. They have very little understanding. So the first problem is to become aware of how we view one another. And then the second problem is to begin a dialogue on all sides to try to establish our common values, our common concerns, our common problems, and to begin talking to one another. And I never say that this will be an easy thing to do. But I do emphasize that we have not yet begun to even tackle this problem. And I don't think we're going to get very far in the 21st century with liberation for anything without advancing together and beginning these very early forms of these very rudimentary forms of dialogue and interparticipation in one another's concerns.
How would you respond to the claim that forming alliances with other struggles is a losing strategy because while advocates for other animals will, for example, support gay rights, gay liberation advocates will, for the most part, be unlikely to stop contributing to the exploitation of other animals. In other words, will be joining their struggles while they, by and large, ignore the animal movement, doing nothing in return.
If we can explain to other movements, such as the environmental movement, if we can clearly explain the environmental impact of consuming animals for meat, I don't see how they can deny that we are interrelated struggles and we need to fight. We need to fight together as one. The speciesist issue reaches really far into human history and to human psychology and to social structuration, if you will, the forming of societies, and to social evolution, the change of these societies over time. And if we can see, if we can clarify to people that the oppression of animals, speciesism, is directly related to the oppression of human over human in various ways, patriarchy, racism, slavery, etc., then I think we can begin to shed a lot of light on the darkness of history. Marx one time said that class struggle is it's the secret of history. It's the enigma of history resolved. And that we've never really learned how to look at history correctly without a class lens, and we can't, he would say. I agree with that, but I would add to that that we can't look at history adequately without a species lens, without looking at speciesism and what human animals have done to non-human animals and how that has affected our social world and the natural world generally. So I think we have to get disability rights movements, gay rights movements, feminist movements, social justice movements of all kinds to see that, number one, there are interconnections between our struggles or among our struggles. And number two, this planet is going nowhere. Nobody is going to have rights of any kind. They will never have a chance to be addressed unless we can immediately stop the environmental crisis. And key to stopping the environmental crisis is stopping the industrialization of factory farming spread throughout the world. Because we know that this is the number one environmental problem that we're facing on this planet today. So it really gets down at a certain point to very basic realities. We will not even have societies that are decent enough to fight for anyone's rights if the natural world is so degraded that we are struggling just to survive. So we need to show to people the importance of the vegan and animal rights and animal liberation struggles for everyone's struggles. And we need to show that we have common things that we share. We have common values, non-discrimination, for instance, justice, peace, equality, nonviolence, and we have common concerns.
When we look at other struggles for social justice, we're looking at struggles in which those who are the ones that are being oppressed are part of their own struggle. Is the animal movement significantly different, do you think, because those who are oppressed are not part of the actual struggle to end their own oppression? Other animals can't organize, or they can't, they don't exert political power. So if so, are the lessons from other struggles really applicable to this movement?
Yes, I think we need to acknowledge the differences between the animal liberation movement and social liberation movements and earth liberation movements, which are always interconnected with social liberation movements and humans, typically defending their own interest on having a viable planet. So as you mentioned, we need to recognize that animals, I think it's wrong to say they can't speak for themselves. They do very poignantly and very eloquently in various ways, from the sadness in their eyes to the piercing shrieks of their cries in systems of confinement and torture. In ways they can speak for themselves, but they don't speak for themselves as citizens. They don't speak for themselves in human language except through a very artificial means that we can construct with chimpanzees, etc. So they don't form unions. They don't have social relations of interest as we know them. So that means that really we are, in some significant sense, a voice for the voiceless, that we really are fighting on behalf of them, that the animal liberation movement is an avant-garde of human beings fighting for the interests of other beings and trying to represent those interests in the most accurate and empathetic ways possible. So there are differences in these various movements that have to be acknowledged. But what also needs to be acknowledged is that animals have distinct interests, such as humans have, that animals suffer under systems of confinement, slavery, and exploitation, no different than humans do, and that the exploitation of animals now is the number one problem in the state of the environment in the 21st century.
I definitely agree with you. Other animals do certainly speak for themselves. They don't necessarily need us to speak for them to say that they're suffering and they're being exploited, and what we do to them is absolutely horrific. So I agree. I don't think that they're voiceless. They certainly have a voice if we're prepared to listen to them. I guess what I was asking, I often hear analogies with the human slavery movement and how people assume that that ended, and they assume that we should learn from that, and if we do the same sort of things, that we're going to end the suffering and the slavery of other animals.
No, I agree that these analogies, a lot of the politics of animal liberation today are about the validity of analogies. And an analogical argument is one that, yes, there are differences between things we're trying to compare, but the similarities are more important than the differences. And the similarities are deep and profound enough to show that there are truly viable, valid analogies here that we're trying to understand. So when we talk about human slavery and animal slavery, indeed, there are very important commonalities here that we need to grasp if we are to shed light on any particular kind of slavery. The two most volatile terms in the animal rights, animal liberation movement today are, I think, animal slavery and the Holocaust, the animal Holocaust. Animal slavery, if we just pick up on that issue, is a very debated term. There have been some hugely intense conflicts over the term animal slavery in the U.S. and other countries, particularly in the U.S., where human slavery has played such a profound role, the oppression of African Americans, reduction of them to slaves in this society. Black African Americans have really resisted using the term animal slaves because they feel it degrades the human slave to the status of animals, which is what has happened to them historically. Similarly, leftists of all stripes will reject the term animal slavery because they believe falsely that animals are not conscious subjects, that they're closer to chairs and tables than they are to human animals and human beings. And so you can't really validly talk about the slavery of an animal, but in fact you can. And one of the things I try to establish in my book is that as I work through these analogies, that animals are slaves because they are, in Marxist terms, laborers whose labor is exploited. We reduce them from free-living beings to laborers, slaves, in systems of confinement, and we take the value out of their labor, what Marx called surplus labor. And that value can be their meat, their bodily fluids. It can be their muscular power. It can even be what they can produce for scientific data. So whether we're looking at fur farms, factory farms, hunting systems, or vivisection laboratories, we can see that we reduce animals to the status of slaves in society, that animal slavery is a primordial and powerful form of slavery. It influenced the way we looked at humans as slaves, both conceptually and with the technologies that we developed from enslaving animals. We applied those to enslaving humans. So here too, we see connections between human slavery and animal slavery, the human exploitation of animals and the human exploitation of humans. These are all interconnected.
Steve, what was it that caused you to become a vegan and an advocate for animal liberation? And how did you then come to the view that alliance politics was so important for the animal liberation movement?
I was in a unique position in my own history and political trajectory to understand the importance of total liberation and the uniqueness of this for our movement today. I started off in the early 1980s as an aware young person, becoming aware of human imperialism and fascism and these kinds of problems in society. I gravitated rather quickly in my early college training toward a Marxist and leftist perspective. And I came to understand what capitalism is and what systems of systematic enslavement are, such as fascism and capitalism. And so I came from that humanistic leftist perspective. I was by no means a vegetarian, vegan, or animal rights activist from the start. But I came to have an appreciation for what exploitation is, for what slavery is, for what disempowerment is, for what suffering is. And so around the early, in the mid-1980s, I read Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation. It instantly made sense to me. And I instantly made a lot of changes to my lifestyle, first by going vegetarian, soon thereafter vegan. And I started to put started to connect the dots. I started to see how the oppression of animals affected human social relationships and affected the environment and was oppressive to humans in many different kinds of ways. So I would say by the early 1990s, I had started to really put these dots together and see that all these systems of oppression were interconnected, and to see that veganism was not just a lifestyle choice, not just a diet, but really a profound way of living on this planet, and a profound way of struggling against other forms of injustice.
Steve, would you please expand on your view that people on the left are resistant and stubborn about animal rights and veganism?
Well, the people on the left, and I know this because I came from the left for a good decade before I started becoming a vegan and animal rights activist, and I tried to persuade the left as soon as I saw the connections myself that, hey, if we're talking about rights, if we're talking about justice, we're talking about community, we're talking about autonomy, we're talking about most basic ways in which beings should be able to live on this planet without being exploited, without being made forced to suffer and labor for another. I said to people in so many different settings, we have to look at what we are doing to the animals. But the left, in my experience, has always resisted this and still today does resist this. And anybody who's tried to argue with the leftists will have had the same kind of frustrations that I have had. They tend to create a strong dualism between human beings and non-human beings. They tend to speak of humans versus animals, so failing to recognize the fundamental fact that we are animals, and therefore that everything that we have about us, there's not one quality all the way up to our appreciation of art, our experiences of love, our capacity to feel sorrow, all of these aspects of human being come from animals. We invented none of them. They are deep in our animalic history, and we go back in history 5 to 7 million years as primates. We didn't begin to exist as a species until about 200,000 years ago. So everything we have, everything we are, is an evolution, an articulation, a refinement of what we were as animals, of what animals have given to us as we live in this world. So the leftists have failed to appreciate that. They can understand Darwinism for the evolution of society and the evolution of the natural world, but they don't grasp that we have evolved out of animals as animals. They somehow miss that very important connection that, by the way, Darwin never missed. Darwin was one of the first people to emphasize in the late 19th century the emotions and intellectual and, if you will, personality or spiritual capacity of animals being very akin to ours. So leftists don't get that. And leftists also view us as a largely white, mainstream, middle class or elitist movement. And unfortunately, they are correct in that, because this movement does not have social depth. The animal rights and vegan movements, I think, largely are too exclusionary, too elitist, it lacks the diversity that we need to have as a viable social movement. And the diversity that we need to have, we would only attain by interacting with other movements, people of color, feminist movements, gay liberation movements, disability movements, certainly the environmental movements, you name it. This would give us greater strength in numbers, and it would strengthen us in terms of our diversity, our ability to see the world from different perspectives and appreciate the interconnectedness of all forms of oppression.
Steve, you reminded me there of something you said a number of years ago in Shannon Keith's first film, Behind the Mask. You said, in speaking about comparisons made between different species, that humans are not particularly exceptional, that humans do have certain abilities that most other animals don't have, but other animals equally have abilities that humans don't possess. For example, humans are not able to soar like an eagle.
All animals have their own capacities, their own. The idea of a unique species is redundant, isn't it? Because all species are unique. All species have unique capacities. And we can't hear like a bat. We can't see like an eagle. We don't have the agility of a gazelle. We certainly don't have the strength and power of a lion. And that's why we have technology, because when it comes to our fingernails and our muscular strength and whatever we have physically, we cannot compete with animals. And it's been shown, for instance, in various studies that chimpanzees have demonstrated better analogical thinking abilities than even college undergraduates. So we really have underestimated the beauty, the wonder, still the mystery, the capacities, the evolved capacities of other animals. We have consistently underestimated this, as conversely we have overestimated our capacities. We call ourselves Homo sapiens, or Homo sapiens sapiens, to be perfectly redundant. That would be humans that evolved about 50,000 years ago into complex forms of culture and language, painting, etc. We think that we are the wise species, that there is not intelligence and wisdom and beauty and subtlety and grace and just amazing qualities like a rainbow and other species, that we alone possess value or uniqueness in the world. I think I recall Murray Bookchin, a prominent environmental writer from the United States, who said that if human beings did not value the world, there would be no value in the world. And that shows you the kind of ridiculous arrogance that we have as humans in failing to appreciate the beauty and magnificence of other beings, other species, and their incredible forms of intelligence. And really overestimating our own intelligence on this planet. We're so intelligent that we have painted ourselves into a corner. We are in an evolutionary dead end right now. And unless we really start making radical changes in our society, we will not escape this. And this planet will devour us and overwhelm us and create something far beyond us.
Steve, would you agree that humans have behaved as imperialists in relation to other animals, that humans occupy the earth rather than inhabiting it, and that our species needs to be pushed back to what might be termed pre-invasion boundaries in terms of our numbers and technological impact on other creatures? Has the human Reich succeeded in imposing our own version of the Nazis' Lebensraum on other beings that we arrogantly consider to be our inferiors? Is it a case of animal liberation, but not too much, with animal advocates who refuse to understand this?
Yeah. Well, I like the term human Reich, and I think I've tossed it around myself at various points, meaningfully so. We talked earlier about the politics and problems of analogy. I think we can talk about human imperialism, human supremacism, the human Reich, like we would talk about the German Reich, the Nazi Reich, or racial or white supremacism. These are direct analogies and corollaries between these kinds of terms and concepts. We have acted on this planet, as Isaac Bashevis Singer has said so eloquently in his novels, like Nazis. We are a planetary Nazi. We have exceeded our boundaries. We do not respect the fact that we belong to a vast, vast global bio-community that we are utterly dependent upon. And we have deluded ourselves into thinking that we are like some technological floating castle above it all, and that we can just ram through this and destroy it and consume it according to our purposes, and that there is no limits to our capacity to consume on this planet, no natural limits, and there's always a solution for every problem we create, a techno-solution. Well, now we are starting to realize in the 21st century that our thinking on this planet has been utterly barbaric in our way of being on this planet. Utterly barbaric and utterly unsustainable and catastrophic, and the bills are now due. We are now going to pay for thousands of years of delusionary thinking. And we have to go back 10,000 years to the emergence of agricultural society, as all good scholars will. Then we will see the shift from hunting and gathering societies to formalized agricultural societies and formal systems of organized power and states and social hierarchies of various kinds, patriarchy, statism, classism, racism, that never existed before, and understand that all of these came out of, if you will, I think organized hunting. And we can go back maybe 80, 90,000 years ago. And as soon as we became technologically evolved enough for the systematic hunting of animals such that we could surround large land mammals and we could bring these down. We had made a fundamental shift in history, the likes of which have not since been seen, the shift from being the hunted to the hunter. And we became the hunter. As soon as our technological capacities evolved enough, we began to systematically wipe out life forms. We began to systematically wipe out ecosystems. And these were local. And now we see with the problem of climate change today that this has accelerated to a global level. We have intervened in the planet to such a dramatic extent over particularly the last 10,000 years that we have altered the very climate and very basic forms of balance and stability on this planet. Really hard to believe. It's really hard to confront the extent to which we have invaded and embedded ourselves in this planet. And this really all begins with the systematic destruction of animals and of the habitats that followed. And then we turn those powers on one another, and we began systematically destroying ourselves and slaughtering ourselves throughout history.
And just leading on from that, Steve, isn't it the case that many people that consider themselves animal liberationists don't really see this? They're concerned about maybe ending the fur trade, ending experiments on animals, even promoting veganism, but they don't really understand the depth to which animals have been exploited and persecuted by humans, and the extent to which we really need to change the world in order to truly liberate animals.
The movement, if I could say, lacks a lot of historical and intellectual depth. Earlier, your comments, Ronnie, had alluded to something called primitivism, which has a whole other layer of problems to it. But one positive thing about the so-called primitivists, these are people who celebrate pre-agricultural forms of living on the planet, and they rightly show that our true forms of alienation and exploitation and the chaos we've wreaked on this planet began with agricultural society, such that it's not unfair to say capitalism is an extension of agricultural society, because agricultural society, at essence, was a system of unsustainable growth. And what is capitalism but a grow-or-die system? These kinds of insights, these kinds of connections are really not sufficiently understood by the animal movement. And perhaps if they did, there would be more emphasis on alliance politics and understanding that there's such a tangle of problems that is so deeply interconnected, beginning with speciesism and moving through sexism and fascism and patriarchy and racism. I guess I just want to say I want to highlight the problem of going back into time, because what the primitivists want to do is to go back to a pre-agricultural mode of being and to systematically dismantle all advanced forms of science and technology. I'm not sure that's possible. I'm not sure it's desirable. There are many different opinions about this. So that's kind of an allusion to your earlier question I wanted to follow up on. There's no clear idea or no solid consensus on how to move forward into a viable future. Do we systematically disassemble our advanced forms of science and technology? Is that possible? Or can we somehow find a way to harmonize our advanced knowledges with living on the earth in a way that is sustainable and compatible with other forms of life? Can we do this? Can we do this in our human nature? Or is human nature itself something flawed, something problematic, something that is innately flawed, innately wrong? There are these questions that reach into biological issues that get uncomfortable to the extent that we cover over social issues and social causes of oppression and social causes of environmental problems, etc. But there is something to the human animal itself that, to me, is starting to see deep seem to be deeply flawed. So in the book, I speculate about, you know, where this is going. When you look at the wreckage of the last 10,000 years in history, and you see that we have evolved from species of societies into statist societies, into class of societies, into patriarchal societies, into empires and into clashing empires, and into eventually colonizing every aspect of this earth and systematically pushing out other species by the thousands. Can we stop this? Is this something that we can is it within our capacities to learn, to harmonize, to connect, and to radically change, or is the inertia too strong, or are we simply innately flawed animals? We have set ourselves on a path that we cannot ultimately change. I've become more pessimistic about these issues over the years. I've seen the problems be much deeper than people acknowledge. I think that calls for go vegan and vegan liberation as panaceas for the vastly intricate social and natural problems we face on this planet today. These calls for go vegan are just hopelessly inadequate. And so I've turned to a much broader visions of how to systematically change our societies. I think capitalism is an unsustainable form of social existence. I think it needs to be wiped out. Can we? Do I think this is easy? I don't know, and no, it's not. But I know that we are living in an unsustainable form of existence right now, and that means that the only question facing us is not veganism, but revolution. Of course, veganism will be a part of that revolution, but absolute radical revolution, where we change every aspect of our thinking and of our social existence. We need to do this. Can we? I'm not sure. You know, I'm not the Marxist in the 19th century who was so blindly naive and optimistic about our powers to systematically change ourselves and our societies. I don't know if we can do that. I know we have to do that. And I think total liberation is our best option. And I can see the inadequacy of purely vegan or animal rights approaches, of just single-issue approaches of any kind. I can see the great inadequacy of those tactics.
Steve, in the book you raise the possibility of a post-human future, a world without us, and I'm thinking about now based on what you were just saying. So you ask whether humanity should survive, not whether it can survive. So how do we think seriously about this, and should we think seriously about it?
Well, we should think very seriously about this. We should think very seriously about our value to this planet, about who we are and what we have been and what we want to be. These are the most serious, urgent questions I can think of. It is very hard to detach from thinking of the value of oneself as an individual to the planet. It is very hard to be an existentialist and to say, well, my death will mean nothing ultimately, because we cling desperately to our lives in most cases. And we like to think that there is a reason for and value of our existence on this planet. Similarly, we really struggle with the idea, and I don't think this idea has been struggled with in any serious way, of the value of Homo sapiens to this planet. Recall, I quoted someone earlier who said that if humans weren't there to make value on this planet, there would be no value. There'd be nothing of interest, literally nothing of interest, people have said, nothing of value on this planet. Well, I think to the contrary. I think that we have taken ourselves to an evolutionary crossroads where it is now that we either radically revolutionize our lives and harmonize our existence with the planet in some sustainable and viable way, or that we should just get off this planet, because no species has the right to drive and control the evolutionary fate of tens of thousands, millions of other species. And so in line with some other writers on this topic, there have been various books and even documentaries to the effect of A World Without Us. I imagine what it would be like for the Earth to be literally post-human, to return to a stage, say, before 200,000 years ago, when we really didn't exist as species. We were just primates who didn't speak and didn't have that advanced forebrain and those coming advanced technologies. The Earth is middle age, so the Earth has plenty of time for evolution, billions of years, another 4 or 5 billion years as this planet has in it. So if we were gone, if we were, if we somehow became obsolete or extinct in the next 100,000 years or 1,000 years, let's say 1,000 years, imagine the life forms that would proliferate on Earth. They would be fantastic. They would be bizarre. They would be amazing. There would be another Cambrian explosion of species coming to life on this planet. There would be a sudden new diversity of life forms because we are stopping the evolutionary process. We have brought the evolutionary process, which is the essence of life on this planet, to a close. We are not allowing the evolutionary process to unfold. This is a period of devolution, of species extinction. This is the sixth massive extinction crisis in the history of the planet. The last one was 65 million years ago. And here we are, now in the 21st century, in the midst of the sixth great species extinction crisis in the history of the planet. All the other five were driven by natural events. We are driving this one. And so we have to ask, what is the value of our species to this planet? And clearly, the Earth would say, the animals would say, most generously, that if you cannot harmonize your existence with ours, it is best that you leave. And now to invoke Thomas Malthus, we may not want to leave, but we might have to leave. And our population numbers, and to invoke the primitivist theme here again too, our population numbers could be reduced from 7 billion to a few hundred million because of disease, because of famine, because of warfare, because of nuclear warfare or Ebola, whatever it takes to reduce our species numbers. They will be reduced. It's not a question of do we need to or will they be. It's just a question of how we will do this, through our own free choice or through the stern punishment of the natural world, if you will.
So changing topics just a little bit, what is pacifism in your view, and what are your arguments for rejecting it as it's most commonly talked about within the animal movement?
Well, I make a distinction between pacifism and passivism. I play off that pun in the English language. Pacifism is not a passive struggle. It's not a struggle of the weak. It's not a struggle of those who lack courage. This is a struggle of the brave and the strong. So I have a lot of respect for the pacifist traditions throughout the world, certainly such as emerged with Gandhi and King in the 20th century. And, of course, there's a history before that. So pacifism is a rather utopian view of the world, that the world is beleaguered beset from the problems of violence, that dominator societies that we have created since agricultural society are inherently violent societies, and the only answer to violence is love or peace. And so we have to struggle against all kinds of violence as a kind of cancer in our societies, a cancer in our ways of being. Indeed, it is. We have to struggle against violence through nonviolence, and we can create a peaceful world. Now, we all seek a peaceful world. I don't think there's any question about that. I don't know anybody but lunatics who envision a world that they want to be full of conflict, strife, suffering, bloodshed, and war. So we all want a peaceful world. The question is, how do we get to that peaceful world? And there the real debate begins. Do we always follow the law? Well, we know that those in a nonviolent tradition, in the civil disobedience tradition, did not follow the law. Because they believed that the law was wrong, and so they had to break it to create a higher law, a greater law within societies. So pacifism is not a form of legalism. It's certainly not a form of disengaging from societies or being reduced to a passive entity. But I note that something has emerged in the vegan and animal rights communities today that I call passivism, P-A-S-S-I-V, with that unique spelling, that we have become passive, that we have become complacent. I have noticed in the vegan and animal rights community a tendency to run from a serious discussion of the real problems afflicting our social and natural worlds, because it's so much easier to make the panacea of veganism the solution to all of our world's ills. But guess what? It's not. We need many more forms of change and struggle than that. So I try to argue for a new kind of position, which I simply call pluralism, and that is and contextualism. I say, let's look at each specific situation, because situations historically, spatially, culturally all differ. There's no one solution to how to struggle in Brazil right now as to how to struggle in England or Australia or the United States. Everything is different. Every context is different. And so let's just open this up. Let's open up our terrain of struggle a little bit and not inhibit ourselves with these dogmas that the only way to create change is through nonviolently resisting very violent systems of power. And in some cases where nonviolence, strict nonviolence will work, let's pursue it. We should never use violence when we don't have to. But in other cases where the systems of power and the police state are so entrenched, are absolutely so brutal and murderous, it may be very hard to fight these systems through simply laying in the streets, through simply holding our arms together in a chain and chanting peace solutions. We will just be systematically eliminated, and we will not effectively be able to change these odious structures. So in history, we can see that sometimes nonviolent forms of change have worked, and sometimes violent forms of change have worked. There are many instances where rioting, where armed struggle, where revolutionary wars were necessary to end one form of oppression and did end it, and nothing else might likely have been able to do that. So I'm just trying to open up the field of struggle a little bit, because I think it's been far too constrained by pacifist dogmas. And what's happened in the vegan movement is things have gotten so bad that, I wish the movement were following the lead of King and Gandhi. You know, we follow them in our words, but we don't follow them in our actions. And I imagine what a vegan animal rights civil disobedience movement would be, how powerful it could be if we systematically intervened in the basic operations of society and just found a way, as Gandhi and King tried to do, to bring the system down, to put our levers in the machinery of power, and to slow it down, to stop it, and to just become a real source of resistance in the society. Because what I see in some of the dominant vegan approaches today is I see disagreement with political demonstrations, with open rescues, certainly. Forget about closed rescues and ALF forms of sabotage, which are instantly defined as and derided as violence, nonsense. I see a movement that has left itself no options to even struggle in the streets, to even confront police and systems of power and oppressors, because that's what Gandhi and King both agreed on. That we have to create tension in society. It's there already, but we have to create more to create change. And I've seen that we've lost that will in the vegan and animal rights movement, that we are just now talking about education and legislation. We've forgotten all about agitation.
Human beings seem as subject to evolutionary forces as the rest of the natural world. And so do you see evolution operating on a societal level? And if so, do you see it as a process of gradual change, or is it something that's more disruptive or violent?
There's a theory in evolutionary science called punctuated equilibrium, and that is that the change happens both gradually and catastrophically in the natural world. Things change gradually and gradually and gradually, and then finally there is a Cambrian explosion. There is a radical extinction event or a speciation event, and suddenly things are literally, I mean, overnight in evolutionary terms, change happens overnight, which may be tens of thousands of years at least. So similarly in society, change kind of builds up and builds up, and we have revolutionary events. We have the French Revolution, the American Revolution. We have the 1960s, which seemed to foment revolutionary change, but ultimately it was not strong enough to create a real break in social institutions, and nor was the Occupy movement. So change builds gradually, and this gradual change can lead to a real rupture. And what we need is a rupture in society. We don't need gradual change. We need an absolute break from the errors of agricultural and capitalist, speciesist, anthropocentric society. We need a break from these things. I don't see gradually modifying this as being the way to go. And perhaps someday in the near social future there will be such a break. It seemed like the Occupy movement, which was the most exciting thing to happen in the U.S., in some 50 years since the civil rights movements and anti-Vietnam War movements, been the most exciting thing to happen, but it ultimately went nowhere. So that was no break. There was no rupture. In the 60s, ultimately, was no break and no rupture. I think we need a break and a rupture.
It seems like if sabotage and open rescue and those type of tactics are going to have the effect to change the structures of society that would be necessary in order for widespread veganism to take hold, it would seem like the scale of those sorts of operations would have to be so large, given how pervasive the problem is, that if you had the numbers of people that could carry out the civil disobedience on that large a scale, that you wouldn't need the civil disobedience.
Well, that's not our problem, unfortunately. We've seen some really dramatic actions in Italy and in Brazil in the last few years where people have done some very bold and dramatic raids into animal confinements. So we can see that the power that we can have when we are bold and we are daring. And certainly throughout the history of the ALF, we have seen countless examples, dozens, hundreds, thousands of examples of animals that were free, and were free only through those means and no other possible means. This doesn't mean that these are the only effective means of struggle or liberating animals, that they can be detached from education and other forms of peaceful change. It just means that we cannot stigmatize these historically proven effective forms of struggle as violence. This is what passivists do. They're not violent. They're just simply necessary, and they're necessary when they are necessary, and intelligent people will know. Even if we had massive armies of animal liberationists, would that be enough to win our cause? No, because we can only win our cause when we can win our cause more broadly, and there's no such thing as our cause. There is simply the cause of emancipation on the planet. We cannot liberate animals without liberating humans. We cannot liberate animals without liberating the environment. There are some very basic relationships here to be understood. For instance, we know that often poor people are driven to exploit their natural environments, or are driven to exploit animals, and that we may not ever eradicate animal exploitation without eradicating poverty, without eradicating class systems, without eradicating imperialism that absolutely underdevelops countries like Africa and turns it into a really trying, desperate place, to put it lightly. And we know, for instance, that there are strong parallels and relationships between the education of women, their empowerment in society, and the rate of population growth. Where women are educated, population growth always is lower rather than higher. There are some really basic connections, and wherever populations drop, This is good both for human, for social worlds and for natural worlds and for animals. So there are really some important relationships to understand about the overall balance on the planet. And so, again, even if we had an army, an unimaginable army of a million liberationists, we would still need more. We would still need not only to challenge the fur farms and the factory farms, but to challenge the sweatshops and to challenge the large corporations and to challenge the banking system and to challenge the values of society. And guess what? The animal rights movement, the vegan movements can't do this by themselves. They don't have the capacity to do this by themselves. They don't have the historical experience, the intellectual knowledge, the social experience to do this themselves.
What do you think about the claims that I often hear that as vegans we're winning and that there are more vegans on the planet every day? Why are the huge increases in consumption of other animals in countries such as Indonesia or even India and China? Why are they being ignored?
Yeah, it's a mystery to me because I think there is a tendency in the vegan movement, let's be frank, toward panaceas, toward simple thinking, toward fundamentalism, toward denial of the radical extent to which we are in crisis on this planet today. And it's very easy to get that tunnel vision and talk about the Whole Foods stores that are developing in our neighborhoods and the new vegan recipes and the new vegan outreach pamphlets and the three friends I've converted to veganism in the last year. You mentioned China, India, and Indonesia. These are three of the top four most heavily populated nations in the world, China, India, and Indonesia. And so when we look at the broader picture, we can see that, well, maybe that Whole Foods store, maybe that new recipe book, maybe those new two vegan friends of mine aren't that significant in the big picture of the global picture, and that's dispiriting. And we're an optimistic movement. We don't want to feel defeated, but we're getting defeated. I'm sorry to say. I've always been the guy in the room that says, no, we're losing. And you can only see that when you look at the big picture. So we have a planet today that is characterized by overpopulation, by gigantic societies like India, China, and Indonesia moving toward meat consumption, away from plant-based diets. We have species extinction. We have climate change. We have resource scarcity. We have resource wars opening all over the planet. Everywhere is a hotspot. We are heading down a Malthusian black hole of utter darkness and despair. Now, to flip that over, we have to appreciate what is truly positive and important about veganism and the animal rights movement. And I try never to minimize this. I just don't want to overstate it, you know. We are the bearers of sanity and peace and compassion. And we are addressing some of the root causes of hierarchy and environmental destruction on the planet today. We are important. And I want to flip that over one more time, not to congratulate ourselves too much, because the people in the vegan and animal rights movements, I'm sorry to say, I'll happily include myself among them, are not always very good people. We are not the bearers of evolutionary avant-garde revolutionary moral change that we think we are. We have a lot of room to grow and evolve as people on this planet. So just because we get the meat connection, just because we understand exploiting animals is wrong, that's the beginning of our own evolutionary change as people. That's not the end. So we have to get the really big picture, and I'm a big picture kind of guy. And so when I look at that's why I subtitle my book Revolution in the 21st Century. The 21st century to me is a point of reference. This is a century of climate change. This is a century of massive human overpopulation. This is the sixth great species extinction crisis unfolding right now. This is the millennium of resource scarcity and resource wars like we have never seen before. This is a do or die moment. If we don't get it right in this century, we never will.
For our final question today, is there anything that we've not thought to ask you that you'd like to say to our listeners?
I think there is a tendency now unfolding in the animal rights movement that I find very alarming. It's a singularly distinct and disturbing form of single issueism. And this is the dalliance, the flirtation, the open alliance attitude of this movement toward fascism. Social fascism is not really an issue in the U.S., but it is in Italy, it is in the U.K., and it is in France and other countries. That there are social fascist tendencies rising up throughout society, and that they are making incursions into the animal rights and animal welfare movements. Now, a total liberation approach will have nothing to do with these movements. We need alliance politics, but not alliance with right wingers, not alliance with fascists, not alliance with the most regressive tendencies that have ever arisen in the 20th century. Talk about the slaughter bench of history, the 20th century. And alarmingly, fascism is not dead. Fascist and Nazist ideologies are still alive. They're still circulating throughout societies, and they are now encroaching in this animal rights movement. And I find this utterly alarming. So I am open to any kind of alliance and growing this movement with progressive social movements, so long as they are progressive, but not the most regressive ideas and ideologies to ever come out of history. And that is fascism. Fascism is what? It is totalitarianism, it is anti-Semitism, it is racism, it is exclusionism, it is white supremacism, it is repugnant and violent and malignant and militarist and ugly and regressive, and it is going to take this movement down the wrong path. So I'm trying to point out generally the problems with single-issue movements, such that we can be in PETA and we can wear KKK costumes, and this has been done to draw publicity to our events. We can put women in cages to talk about the exploitation of animals, ignoring the exploitation of women. And we can use anti-Semitist images. We can use rather Nazist images to promote our cause. And what? There is nothing fundamentally wrong about this, or this is going to gain us the adherence that we, the followers that we need from other social movements. You know, these short-term victories that sabotage our long-term progress. We're doing this to ourselves again now with working with the far right, the right, or fascist movements. And let me say, I've noticed there are three open tendencies right now. There is overt open fascism. There is what I call fascist-friendly approaches, which are people who will work with anyone else of any kind of persuasion so long as they are down with helping animals. And if they're fascist, oh, well, so be it, just a side problem. And there is anti-fascism. I think the animal rights movement needs to be anti-fascist. We cannot be a vehicle to promote the most regressive social ideologies to emerge in the last couple of centuries. And we are, whether we acknowledge it or not, whether people realize it or not, this is a left-wing movement. The vegan movement and the animal rights movement are left-wing movements because we promote left-wing values. These values are values of peace, democracy, rights, community, inherent worth, non-hierarchy, non-discrimination, etc. And right-wing values are just the opposite. They're values of violence, militarism, racism, discrimination, hierarchy. You see that we have a tradition, whether we realize it or not, we are building on and extending from the traditions of the most progressive social left-wing progressive movements in America and Europe and elsewhere, beginning from the 18th century up to the present. Those are the values we need to build on. We are bringing the best of human morality, the best of human ethics, the best of human being to a higher plane. Because these social movements, these humanist left-wing social movements, they did not fulfill their own values. And we are here as historical bearers of progress to bring these values to fruition. And now we can't do it by ourselves. We need these very traditions from which we have sprung.
Steve, I'd like to thank you very much for spending your time with us today, and I'd also like to thank you sincerely for everything that you continue to do on behalf of both humans and other animals.
Thank all of you. I really appreciate this interview. It's really been enriching for me.
You're most welcome. Thank you for listening to AR Zone. Please visit us online at www.arzone.net and look for us on iTunes.